first thing he said was like, well, we already filled that position. How do you feel about sales? And it was like, oh, I've got strong feelings about sales, not positive ones necessarily. But, you know, you got to make ends meet. So I was like, oh, sales sounds great.
David, I'm starting a coffee cart. Should I get a Linea Mini or a GS3? I'm sure you get that one.
3 times a week at least. Usually I feel like I'm having that conversation.
Welcome and welcome back to another episode of the Valor Coffee Podcast. We had the honor, the privilege, nay, the pleasure of sitting down with our coffee crush, David Lamont. David has been in the coffee industry almost longer than we've been alive, guilty, and he has awesome stories to share with us. He has so much experience and wisdom. We were honored to hear what he had to say, and I know that you will enjoy it, you specifically. We also got to taste some amazing coffee. One of our favorite roasters of all time, Proud Mary, out of Portland and Melbourne. We kind of tried 3 different coffees, and they were all super cool in their own ways. Just another highlight to the closer we are getting to our Valor community. There will be a link to sign up for that community at the top link in the description, the show notes, our bio. It'll be everywhere. There'll be links everywhere. This is a great opportunity for someone who is new, young, old in the coffee industry to connect with roasters and with us and ask questions. We hope you enjoy the show. It was an awesome time. We love you.
What's this cappuccino y'all are drinking?
Oh yeah. So we have,
please,
we have 3 coffees from Proud Mary, brewed a bunch of different ways. Kind of homage to last week. I don't know if you saw last week, David. We were doing a little trial with 3 pour-over, same coffee, 3 pour-overs,
yes.
3 coffee shots, or the Noma Kano, doing a side by side. So Ross made this double anaerobic honey El Salvador by Proud Mary with the XF, the fellow XF, which we make a lot of our coffees with. And then I did this, still from Proud Mary, anaerobic honey. You want to tell me where you're from? Los Belotos.
A lot of words on that. A
lot of words and the origin. Oh, El Sal, another El Sal.
Wait, so this is that?
This is that.
Ah, sorry, I didn't see that bag. I kind of lost it. There we go. There's the one. But I guess for the camera, right?
Yeah, it's for the people.
It's for the people.
Boop. And then this one here is a Panama Geisha.
Oh, interesting. And that's, how did you brew that one?
These are both with the like coffee shot. Are you
I listened to that? I listened to that one, and there's like, the Noma Kano is something I wanted to try.
Yeah.
Today's your day.
There we go. Awesome.
We can try
on the table. Shout out to Adrian from Proud Mary for sending these coffees.
Thanks, Adrian. That's a pretty penny.
For sure.
But I mean, the sales they're going to generate from this
endorsement is... Yeah, exactly.
Buckle up, Proud Mary production team, because the queue's popping off.
Adrian listened to the episode where I think I said Proud Mary was the Proud Mary coffee I tried in the tin was the best coffee I ever tried. And he was like, I got to get them some coffee. So thank you.
Was that
we're
Alita,
excited to try these.
Alita Estate?
I don't remember what the specific one was. I think it's probably in this email chain. The coffee was...
Noma Kano looking a little cloudy.
It was Lamastis Family Estates.
Okay.
I also added 120 grams of bypass water, but last week I only added 100. I'm messing with the variables. Oops.
So we hear it through the grapevine that you are a golfer. Is this true?
I am a driving ranger.
You're a top golfer?
Yeah, almost. Like a buddy of mine tried to drag me into his golf habit not too long ago by sending me one of his old clubs. And so I was like, man, I haven't been to the driving range in 20 years or 15 years or whatever it was. And then I figured out that there's a one just down the street from where I live in Sugar Hill that's like cheap and it's kind of awful. Like the golf ball is like half the time the covers are falling off.
It's like
and
the
stuff
public
like,
course.
Yeah, it's like right behind a Kroger over there in Sugar Hill. But it's minutes away. So I could be like out of my house to the driving range, $5 bucket of balls, you know.
Wow.
Back to the house, no time flat. So not a golfer yet. I went and attempted that a couple of times.
You ever watch golf?
Stick to the range. I don't.
Who I would?
Sports.
Masters only for me.
Really?
Like Sunday Masters. That's it.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a nice little ritual, you know? So that sounds like a fun thing to watch with people.
Yeah.
Watching golf alone sounds like a nap.
Yes. My dad was enjoyed watching sports a lot more than I do by myself. So it's something that didn't stick with me. But what you drinking there?
That is an espresso. Oh, I'm sorry. The espresso and cappuccino are the double anaerobic honey El Sal in the bag that you also have from the pour over. Double anaerobic honey. That's a lot of words.
I was about to ask.
I guess they just, it's so nice, they steep it twice.
Yeah.
They're like, all right, let's put it in another anaerobic container.
There's absolutely no oxygen involved in this.
No.
For sure. Yes. But we are here with David Lamont.
What's up, guys?
Come on.
David Lamont, thank you for making
for
time
on, David.
To hang out with us.
Thanks for inviting me, guys.
I feel honored.
I feel honored. This is pretty cool.
Anytime to be in your presence. I think we've probably said your name, I don't know, probably on like
at least
four
twice.
Or five episodes.
No. Sounds about right.
Throughout
Yep.
At least the Caleb and Will episode.
Yeah, I think that's it. But
there's got to be more.
Maybe.
The best thing ever was the first time we were all getting the coffee. We went to a throwdown at Dancing Goats in Pond City Market. And
whoa.
I don't even know if you were there. But
he wasn't there.
I don't think you were there. There was a picture of me steaming milk and a guy wearing a La Marzocco shirt behind me in the picture. And we were like, I think that's David Lamont. That's David Lamont. And they're like, whoa, he was at the thing. And that's what we thought you looked like, some different man.
Oh, gosh. Now we got to find the photo and figure out who it
gotta
was.
Find.
If it was either Ren or if it was All right. Chandler. If it
you
was,
guys like, talk.
Oh, you're about to find, it? Find the photo?
I have it. Oh, I mean, it's my screensaver. It's me winning my first latte art throwdown.
Oh, did you win the throwdown?
Yeah, we like rolled in. We're Dawsonville boys. And we won. It was sweet.
You won.
We won. That's my biggest accomplishment.
Where did y'all work? Where was your first coffee spot? Forgive me if I'm making you guys repeat stuff. That's probably other episodes.
For Ross and I, it was this place in Gainesville called Midland Station.
Wow.
And it was it was owned by a church in Gainesville. And it essentially was like a deli that had an espresso machine, but they called themselves a coffee shop. They had a Simonelli 2 group. You remember the model of that machine?
Aurelia 2.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Solid machine, except when you engaged the group head, it would like spray hot water everywhere.
Oh, kind like the like super hot, like
gurgling.
As you started it. Yeah, exactly.
The
temp surfing stuff that people had to do.
Maybe. Maybe you obviously know more about this than I do because we got a nameless espresso tech out there to look at it. And he was just like, you just got to let it run for longer. Is that's basically what you're saying, right?
Temp surfing. It was like a thing that, you know, if you go way back in the, home barista forums and stuff like that, that was pretty standard part of people brewing was like, you would run it and it would do the sputtering thing because it's probably over boiling. So as soon as it's hitting the air, it's like, whatever, boiling as soon as it does. So it sprays and hisses and does everything. And then you got to kind of like surf to find exactly that spot where you think it's the right temperature.
Oh,
the first machine I worked on was the same way. It was like when you would just walk up to it and hit the button, the first amount of water it sent out was sputtery and hot and way over the top. So,
Yeah, the only other espresso machines that I was around during that time were in the counterculture training lab. So
I spent a lot of time there.
They had like a Strata and I think a GB5 in there maybe. I forget at that time what was in there. But it was all like great stuff. And
right.
I was like, these don't sputter.
Yeah,
these this guy must be wrong.
I hit the button and it just comes out at the temperature
it comes
I
out
want.
At like, the right temperature.
Yeah, that's the La Marzocco difference right there.
And these machines aren't made of plastic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they
less parts coming off in your hand, but whatever. Yeah.
Yes, for sure.
Hey, you'll be pleased to know. I don't know if the word's gotten to you yet. We just got a Strata S.
I saw.
Oh, yeah.
I saw the order come through. It's pretty exciting. That's really
we're,
exciting.
We're actually. Excited.
We're stoked. The spirit has been a pleasure, but it's time to
retire
step
it to the roastery.
That's right.
Right.
Throw less volume at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you do if you had a 3-group Strata that... Would you just try to sell it? Because we don't need it anymore. It's a manual paddle.
Oh, is it not converted?
Mm-mm. Well, it was converted from something to something. Was it EE?
It was a manual paddle, and now it is converted to where the paddles are just on off switches. I
think that's, okay. Yeah, so it's an MP converted to a EE, yeah. Semi-automatic. Mm-hmm. So no more gauges, no more like...
No pressure.
No nothing. Pressure.
I would almost prefer that in this lab, honestly. So I'm like, could convert it back. I mean, really what would be great is if we could convert it to AV. I don't know if people do that.
That's a lot. Yeah. I mean, this is a conversion that'll like help you if you're trying to sell that to somebody else. I was actually just on the phone with somebody the other day that was considering buying an older MP, and I was asking them, I was like, have you swapped it to EE? Because that's actually probably going to be better for your shop. Because you know, plenty of places run on semi-automatic like that. But
I'm glad we brought you here, man. Let's connect this person and we'll sell them. Just keep our saying
MPs, EEs. Yeah, no, that's we can find picture. A home for that.
Oh, you found
it's
it.
Chandler Rents, the man. Yeah, yeah.
But that's he's not you, though.
Yeah, no, it's not you.
No.
Chandler are you sure that's not you?
Why did we think that was David Lamont?
Because he has a giant La Marzocco logo on his.
Yeah, well, I guess that's like, a start.
Who would wear a La Marzocco merch if right. they don't work for
you're
him?
A sucker.
Yeah.
Well, just like how you've been mentioned in this podcast, your name has just been in the specialty coffee community before we were even younglings in it. So I think we just always wanted to meet David Lamont.
Name lurking awkwardly in the background, like I in person usually am at most events, like
hanging out in the background.
But you work with La Marzocco.
I do.
What is your role?
I am the Southeast Sales Director for that. So I Virginia to Florida, over to Arkansas, Louisiana, like everything in that zone. I'm the person that people talk to who want to sometimes buy La Marzoccos and often be the ones who are selling them and supporting them and doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So do most people buy direct or it's all through local espresso techs?
Very, very few buy direct. It's usually through local espresso technicians or through like roasting companies. Like you mentioned, when I was working at La Marzocco, when I was working at Counterculture, we sold a lot of La Marzoccos and supported them and like provided the service and did that kind of stuff. So I work with those kind of people trying to help the people who are helping the people, you know?
Right.
So people will often call me who are just saying, hey, I want to start a coffee shop and all I know is that I want to use a La Marzocco. That's like literally the only piece of information they have other than maybe a prospective spot. And so they call me like, how do I get a La Marzocco?
Mm. How do they find your number?
They just find La Marzocco. And so they just go to the website and then they, you know, email or call or do something and then get eventually connected up with me. And I try to be as welcoming a first stop as I can be and try to, you know, decipher a little bit of how the system works for them. Mm. But
just on that, what are questions you ask people when they say, I want a La Marzocco machine in my cafe? Where do you go with that conversation?
Is it really?
Yeah, exactly. You sure? Want a cafe? Okay. have you already signed the lease? Is it too late? The first thing I always try to figure out is like who they're already working with or talking to, because I never want to interrupt a relationship accidentally, right? Because I might have kind of like my go-to in their area or a couple of go-tos, but I don't want to like throw out a name and then all of a sudden they've, you know, somebody, some roaster in the background has been doing a ton of work and then I accidentally throw some wrench into the works. So I usually try to just spend a lot of time trying to figure out who they're already connected to. And then, you know, sometimes those are people where it's like an easy conversation and I'm just like, oh, you're talking to those folks, like that's easy. You can buy your equipment through them. They're going to do a great job supporting you. Other times it might be somebody who's not at all a partner. So I kind of help them connect the dots and add to that mix of who they've already got. So.
Gotcha. So what about with, do you help with equipment selection? What are the questions you ask on that front?
Size of the cafe, like what, you know, kind of trying to get a sense of what they want to do, how experienced they are. You know, one of the great things about representing a pretty simple lineup, even though it looks complex online, is that there's kind of a handful of things that I would point them towards. So it's not like this super complex selection process. Some of it comes down to style. Some of it comes down to like budget. Some of it comes down to like features and stuff. So, you know, there's not many times where somebody's coming to me blank and then I'm going to end up trying to push them into a Linea Mini or, you know, on the all far end of the spectrum, like a three group Leva or something like that. It's usually a pretty straightforward formula. So the machine part of it's kind of easy. I think I find more fun in talking to them about what they're trying to do and
yeah,
learn a bit here. More about them. So
I have so many questions.
I know.
Does anyone in the Southeast have a leva?
I was going to ask the same question. What are leva sales like these days?
I think they're, gosh, I don't know. There's a couple of home levas out there somewhere, I think. I don't know if we have any in the Southeast.
Like single groups?
Single groups, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same. Cool. I mean, it's basically the same machine, just a single group size. It's not shrunk down. It's a big machine.
But there's one group.
There's a one
like
group
how big
of
is it compared to that?
Much larger. Well, I mean, width-wise, obviously, it's narrower, but it's a...
height and
there's a lot of height to that thing.
There's a lot of height to that thing. Yeah, exactly.
Can we just break down what a leva is real quick for not me, sure. I know, but the other people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those people.
Those people on all the cameras. Lever machines, you know, when people started first creating espresso, like, you know, kind of that relationship of pressure to the finished cup of coffee, what it looks like, what it tastes like, and all that stuff, it's kind of evolved over the years. At the very beginning of the whole espresso history, you had just like machines that were like coal fired, and the pressure would be just basically contained in like how much pressure you could create by taking water a little bit past boiling in a contained system. And that made a different product coming out, right? So then as people like kind of evolved and were like, what if we push this further? Like, how could we make coffee faster? How could we like do it more efficiently? Somebody came up with the idea of, and I should know this, but I'm on camera and I'm not thinking straight. But somebody came up with the idea of like just taking a giant spring and a piston and filling up a chamber with hot water and then letting the spring and the piston shove that water through very finely ground coffee. The way to do that was by pulling a big handle on a lever that like compressed the spring and then released that piston down through the coffee. So lever machines, plenty of companies still make them. La Marzocco set out a few years ago to kind of take this machine that was a bit antiquated and like still existed in pretty much the form it was a long time ago and update a bunch of the features of it, like make it more temperature stable like we were talking about and make it, you know, make it where you could adjust the pressure and do a lot of stuff. So we came up with this really wild machine called the leva.
So last thing on the leva, I know this doesn't apply to any of our audience, but
that we know
that we know of. There's any coffee carts out there that are looking for a leva?
No. Sorry.
Push!
And 220 volt, right?
Like, yeah.
Haul
I'm
your
sure
generator
it's not
with
fragile
you.
Either. It's, yeah.
Probably. Just put in your contract. You need 220 volt power.
Yeah, they'll give it to you every
they'll
time.
Give it to you.
Yeah. Well, it's they nail that every time, right?
All right. Simulation.
Uh-oh.
Hi, David. I'm starting a coffee cart. Should I get a Linea Mini or a GS3?
Oh, gosh, yes.
I'm sure you get that one.
Three times a week at least, usually. Yeah. I feel like I'm having that conversation. I mean,
did we have that conversation with you?
Did we? I don't know. Did
that
the
sounds
no,
familiar.
The Linea, did the Linea Mini exist when y'all were
I don't
there?
Think it did. Yeah, because, I think it came after.
Because Bellwood got it and we were like, what's that?
Yeah.
Yes. But the single group Linea, which is...
Yes, yeah.
There's I don't know how many of those are floating around.
There's a bunch. There's one for sale around here somewhere. I saw it on Craigslist recently.
Because those things are
me
hot.
Thinks I'm interested.
They're so cool. There's a green one right around here, probably within 3 to 5 miles or somewhere.
How do you know? You just know when things are floating around.
I sold it years ago. And I think that they stopped using it or like changed the business or something. But it's a very cool one.
Okay, back to what Ryan
anyways,
was saying.
Sorry, yeah. Linea Mini versus GS3. My standard answer is like... obviously there's a cost difference, but when it comes to it, for me, I like the GS3 a little bit better for the sake that it's easy to swap between working off the reservoir and working off of like a flow jet.
That's true.
Pressured setup. It's really quick. Like you can, you know, you guys have done it plenty of times, hopefully. Linea Mini is obviously less expensive, but it's also semi-automatic for the sake of...
Oh,
yeah,
that's a big one.
On-off switch, man.
Versus the volumetrics of the GS3.
Which is when you're working a small event by yourself and you're trying to do 100 things in a tiny space. Like,
oh, yeah. Dagum.
Being able to lock that in is kind of nice.
I'm just a sucker for an exposed group head myself.
Same.
Yeah.
I like the space.
When you just like, you feel like you can't see.
Where am I?
Yeah.
I'm going in blind.
Toilet pour filters, smashing it up. I still think the Linea is the right machine for so many people. Just for us specifically in the ideal world. I love.
Are we talking like a 2K price gap here?
Yes, somewhere in that range. Mm.
My thought on it, and I think I've told Coffee Carts this before, is even if the Linea Mini doesn't have the features that you want, don't let that be the thing that stops you from getting La Marzocco.
Yeah.
Because the machines that are below that in different brands, I just say stay away from. Yep. I mean, depending on the trajectory of your business, if you're just like trying out the coffee cart thing as a side hustle, and who knows, maybe the machine ends up on your counter one day and that's still a win for you, sure. Don't spend that much money if you don't want to or don't have the budget for it. But it just because it doesn't, the Linea Mini doesn't have volumetrics or a visible timer or whatever, all the features that you're missing,
right,
it's still worth it to have a La Marzocco.
Yeah, and now, I mean, even the Linea Minis now are connected, so you've got the app. So you can, I mean, through the app, you could even see the timer, I think, if I'm getting this right. So it's like, it's kind of evolved, and that's a bonus on there. But yeah, I mean, I do have that conversation surprisingly a lot, like folks that are looking to start coffee carts and looking to like get into it. And, you know, so it's like, how mobile do you want to be? Are you like a coffee cart? Are you a coffee trailer? Are you a coffee truck? Yeah. Like, I don't know. What are those different breaks?
Do you remember having that conversation with Will that he talked about on the podcast where he's like, David, I'm going to start a coffee cart. And you're like,
Well, yeah, I remember a lot of those. I mean, I think it's funny because I tend to just by personality be a little bit play things a lot safer and like a little bit risk averse on my own, which is why I'm not an entrepreneur in the same way that y'all are. But I have like huge respect, and I think it's really cool when people aren't afraid and go out and do stuff. So then I get to like kind of be the background. I don't know which shoulder I'm on as the voice whispering in the ear of like,
you're in the middle. You're the pragmatic shoulder.
Exactly.
The third shoulder.
The third shoulder is just like right there.
The sternum.
Like, have you thought about?
Yeah. I remember having that conversation with Will because he was like, I want to be a wholesale account. I was like, oh, cool. What are you doing? He's like, I got a Chemex and I'm going to go to some offices and I'm going to brew people coffee. And I was like, I don't know if you hit the like 10-pound, you know, a week minimum of like what you would need to be a wholesale account. And also like, really? That's the business model?
The Chemex model.
Yeah, the Chemex model.
Awesome.
And look at him now, right?
Oh, my gosh.
Like, crushing it.
Vagabond barista to methodical coffee.
Mm. Wild.
Another thing on coffee carts, we have more questions about just your perception of the industry in general as you've gone about your career, but specifically with the introduction of coffee carts and the popularization of those in the industry, one, when did you see that first coming onto the scene from your perspective, and how, like, what did you first think of it?
I think, like the perspective has changed now because I see, you know, where I kind of sit in our company and in regard to the, or like kind of in respect to the region, like a lot of those people do come to me. So I see a whole lot more of it across a wider range. At the time, like the first folks that I knew that were starting carts and doing things, I mean, there's people around here. I mean, like it's, I feel like it's always been there in some way or another. Mm. Friends buying espresso machines to like work catering events for, you know, Octane back in the day, or, you know, just trying to think of like Alex Mays, who's a local coffee hero around here. He had one at one point with some friends where they were like, they just had a little Simonelli Appia that they had picked up somewhere used on, you know, Craigslist at the time or something. And they were going around doing events for stuff and then film shoots. So it's, I feel like it's kind of always been there, but like, I think the way the look and the feel of them and those as a springboard to other bigger business has kind of evolved a good bit. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, as far back as I can remember in counterculture, I feel like in my time there, when I was like working in the wholesale side, there was always somebody working on some sort of more mobile coffee setup.
Yeah.
There was one I remember in particular, a guy named Sean that made one that was like, it was beautiful. But it was like huge. And he put so much thought into it. He crafted it super well. It was incredibly well thought out, every detail about like, okay, this is the pour over station. So he had his like mobile slow bar, of course. Yeah.
Dedication.
And then he had his mobile espresso set up and, they were awesome. And he created them and they were like perfect. And then moving them was, like a Herculean task. And so I think after a couple of events, kind of just the effort that went into it worked against the momentum that he had. Mm. So then it became, if I remember correctly, I think it might maybe pushed him into that place where he's like, all right, I'm either going to go bigger with this and become like a shop, or I'm going to go do something else.
Right. So, yeah, just even from a product line standpoint, I'm sure I wonder how many people start coffee carts versus how many people are starting cafes. Because from my perspective, it seems like more people are starting coffee carts because it's a lower barrier of entry.
Yep.
And I don't know if you would agree with that from your perspective.
I would think so. I mean, I haven't ever run the numbers on it. And I'm, you know, for all I know, there could be just as many actual cafes being opened or people who have, you know, the deli coffee shop combo or whatever it might be. But like you said, that, you know, the appeal of the coffee industry, like the draw of the coffee industry is so strong, right?
Yeah.
Everybody comes that it's in all sorts of different industries, whether it's creative, whether it's real estate, whatever. Everybody's hanging out in Valor. Everybody's coming to your space and they see it and it's kind of like, they're like, man, I wish I could do this. I want to be able to run this coffee shop.
Yeah. Yeah. And at least in our journey, it's like, well, what's the first step?
Right.
You know, you get your feet wet with a cart, or do you just do your normal job for 10 years and save up as much money as you can and then jump in? So that makes sense. And even in events, I had this realization, and I'm not in it as much as you are, but it seems like there's still just a market for coffee carts, in that a coffee cart can pair with any type of event that's happening. So I'm thinking it's pretty rare that, like, an event that we're doing, there's like other coffee carts vying for that event.
Mm. It seems like there's, you don't have like many people like trying to compete for the same space.
Maybe in the wedding industry would probably be my only guess of when that actually is happening. But at least in Metro Atlanta, because there's such a heavy like corporate presence, it's just like they think of us because they go to our coffee shop.
How often are y'all running y'all's? How often is the cart going out for use?
Not often.
Oh, really?
I mean, it's
more often lately. It's like whatever we put into it,
seasonal?
We get out of it. Like, we've never had flyers in our cafes.
I saw the flyers this morning when I grabbed the cappuccino.
We did the flyers, and I think maybe that's why. It is why.
Actually advertising.
Yeah, actually.
And then yes. Yeah, and then you do an event, and then there's obviously X amount of people that are like, oh, I actually do something that this would be good at as well.
Mm-hmm. How
do you have a flyer? Yes.
How many events do y'all think you've done? With the cart, like going
overall
out somewhere. Yeah. Just
honestly, probably not
20 times, 100 times, 200 times.
Like, closer to 100.
I would say
around 100.
Yeah.
Because we catered for like 2 years before we did the pop-up in Alpharetta.
In the co-working space.
We were never just in love with catering. That was never the end.
It's a chore.
You know?
It's a chore.
That's the thing that I think people underestimate, right? That's the, y'all probably know. I don't know. What's your standard advice to somebody who comes to you and says, I want to start a coffee pop-up?
It's mostly him, but I would say most of the time it's to what end?
Yeah.
Exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Why are you doing it? Mm-hmm. What's your timeline? Because that'll tell you how much effort and attention you'll give it. And
yeah.
That's the thing that will sustain it, or it'll just fizzle.
Yeah, exactly. Is it, you know, people who do it as like a kind of a test run of a coffee shop? I think I think that there's a lot of fun. I think a ton of people that get into it maybe don't realize how much fun they're having in creating the cart and thinking through, you know, like how everything's going to work and trying to like, you know, get their systems right before they've ever actually done it.
That's a good point.
And so there's that fun in creating the thing, and like people spend a bunch of time getting it all right and all that stuff. And then you go out and you haul it out into some dirty field or whatever.
Yeah.
You do it once and then you have to pack it up. And then after you've done all this work the next morning, you have to go in and be like, oh my gosh, I got to like clean this thing up and redo it.
You're like, wait, we made how much money?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but it's like, it's just 2 hours. We're just serving for 2 hours. And then you're like, well, I'm putting in about 4 hours on either side of this 2 hours.
Absolutely.
And that's 10 hours.
Exactly. And then the next event you're going to do, you find out that something broke during your last event.
Oh,
and,
yeah. You know. Yeah, I think that was a big shift for us in kind of rolling out the cart again, literally.
Wow.
Is when we first started, we were doing events for what, $500 for an event or something?
Yeah.
$400 probably a time
for
or two.
All of you to be there too? Like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And we weren't taking a dime. You know, it was all going back into the company. And so now it's like a lot of people reach out and we quote them what we quote them, and we just don't hear back. And but it's just, you know, obviously not worth our time, especially as we're trying to not be the ones doing it.
Yeah, because you have to, you got to pay someone to do that.
And that's kind of our philosophy. It's like, let's charge a lot, pay whoever's going to be there a lot, and like, we'll see.
Coffee version of a lot.
I was talking to somebody, I don't remember, I'm trying to remember who it was, but they were saying that they had a cart also, and they were saying that with the cart, they felt like the top leadership in the company, like the owners, were the ones who really needed to work it for it to go as well as they wanted. That it was easier to like let somebody run the cafe than it was for them to let somebody run the coffee cart.
That makes total sense.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Well, there's so many variables that, you know, in a cafe, so much is stable. But in when you're like more or less setting up a cafe and then breaking down a cafe and then driving your cafe to and fro.
Because you all know how easy it is to build a cafe, right? Like just, it's a super smooth process. Yeah, nothing ever goes wrong. So like tearing it down, rebuilding it every single event.
Well, even we did this event yesterday and we had to do a thing where the only way we could get to the fourth floor where we needed to be was to flip the cart vertically and push it in the elevator. And I think you were like, and an employee doesn't have the like clearance for this. You know, like we had to do something risky where Ross is like holding the GS3 while I'm pushing it in.
It's a good machine, David.
Thank you.
Glad to they can go sideways.
I agree.
They actually can work sideways too.
They can endure a lot. The thing they cannot endure, and I'll remind everybody out there, is freezing. Don't freeze your espresso machine.
Don't leave that it in the trailer.
No.
Ooh.
You want to see some?
Last night?
Oh, did it really?
Yeah.
No way.
I didn't know that, but yeah, we'll see.
Hey, timely. Very good.
Oh no.
What happens, David?
Oh man.
Expound.
Yeah, what should we do?
I remember as a kid. So I grew up around here, going to Stone Mountain, like, you know, just like you do in school and stuff. If you live in metro area, and I remember, I feel like it was there, like one of the guides or something showing us where they would like, you know, to crack the stone. So they could like chip stuff apart and you could pour water in. And if it froze during the right time of the year, then you could actually like split stone with water freezing, which is, you know, I don't know why I associate it with Stone Mountain. And maybe that's a missed memory. But if it can take two pieces of granite and cleft them, then you should see what it can do to like a small copper tube inside of an espresso machine.
Yeah.
It's not a pretty sight.
How cold did it get? I think it was like 28 last night.
Yeah.
That trailer's insulated, man.
Yeah, you should see
there's
the wood.
There's sheet metal, there's wood,
and then,
there's
paint on top of the
plywood. Well,
yeah, it's crazy. It's you'll know pretty immediately whether it froze or not. I mean, turn that thing on, fill it up, and if water sprays out of places that you've never seen before,
and if I wonder if that
quarter inch thick metal is.
We definitely left our previous GS3 out in freezing.
Oh, sure. Oh,
and it's still cooking, isn't it, Zach?
So take...
It's still cooking, baby.
Take David's advice. Don't do that, but know the machines are so awesome.
They're so good.
I always get worried because I still sometimes loan out like a Linea Mini or a GS3 that I have for somebody who's trying to do something. And during the winter, it's a little bit nerve-wracking. And I try to try to remind people if you're doing that, you know, the best move is, especially because sometimes the machine that you have on your cart isn't permanent. So it's like... Load everything up, load up the cart, load up all the stuff, put it outside in the trailer, put all your things that you're not worried about, and then keep the machine in the garage plugged in, turned on overnight. And as long as you don't lose power, now the machine's hot and it's going to take care of itself. And then in the morning, you just load that in and go with it.
I think we've said this on the program before, but a huge revelation we had was don't leave the water reservoir in the trailer overnight in the winter or when it's cold at all.
Yeah.
Because then the machine is receiving maybe 40 degree water, and it's having to work twice as hard.
Yep.
Because it's used to receiving whatever the standard is. But that was a good one. But we'll see what happens. We'll report back. This is a progression of events.
Well, he said he has loaners, so we can just.
So we're good. All
right. So you're fine. Yeah, it's totally cool.
Do you have a machine on your counter at home?
I currently have a GS3. At home, that it's kind of a loaner. It's not mine, but it's one of those. It's kind of in the fleet of stuff that I loan out. But
nice.
It sat for a very long time, kind of underutilized. And then I mentioned earlier that my son just graduated high school started college a semester ago. So we had a graduation party for him. And so we set it up as a little coffee bar. My daughter was the barista.
Cool.
All of his friends came over and they were like, you know, slinging iced lattes and mochas and things like that.
That's awesome.
And it was at that point, now 20 years into my coffee career, that my wife discovered that she actually really likes an iced vanilla latte.
Mm.
It took 20 years. Yeah, it turns out that the
pretty good
most agreeable drink on the menu. So now it gets utilized. So now, like, my daughter's making coffee for herself in the morning, and my wife is too. And so sometimes it goes out on loan, and sometimes it comes back. And
nice.
Hey, friendly on the family budget. Have right? The in-house cafe.
Exactly.
Come on.
Should we be leaving our GS3 plugged in?
No.
No. Okay.
So, you know, we usually recommend, I don't know, this is like official. This is not like espresso machine manufacturer gospel, but
just David talking.
Just David talking. Just me, you know, slinging the ideas. Everybody talks about it in cafes. You know, if you got your machine on the bar at the shop, you're leaving that on all night, especially because, like, last thing you want to do is have a opener who's running a little bit late come into a totally cold machine and have however long it takes for that to fire up. Also, just kind of the cycling of the parts, like getting hot, getting cold, doing that stuff.
Or freezing. Yeah.
But with the GS3s and the Linea Minis, if it's not being used, you're better off leaving it off. Mm. Because you're not using it as much, you get more like scale buildup and minerals and stuff. So some of the clogs and things that happen in flow restrictors.
That makes sense.
Chiclers.
We have a couple clogged Chiclers.
Chiclers, yeah. Yeah.
Keep that guitar string on us.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. What string is it? What's the right size string? I forget.
Probably
G?
Probably B string.
Okay.
If I had to guess.
0.6, 0.7, something like that, right?
Not all the way to the thinnest one, but
the clickbait title for this episode would be like how to have a 20-year career in coffee.
Oh gosh. Yeah.
So I just could you just take us through? You can go as short or as long through like how did that evolve? What did you start with? Where did you move? And how'd you end up working with?
I had to like take notes last night to try to remember that stuff. So I'm not going to like,
come on, dude.
I was trying to like make notes to try to remember. Cause it was one of those things that, you know, if enough time passes.
Where did I work?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And my wife's got a better memory for all that kind of thing anyways. So,
where was I in 2013?
Yeah. What were we doing? So, excuse me. I kind of fell into coffee. Like my wife and I were living in Japan at the time. And then moved back here and I started grad school at Georgia Tech, thinking I wanted to like kind of continue that connection to living overseas and stuff. So I started an international affairs program, master's degree, and combination of that and some culture shock and stuff. I was just like, wasn't feeling it. And at the same time we were living in Alpharetta and there was a little coffee shop that had just opened up called Cambridge Coffee or World Famous Coffee originally. That was kind of the name they opened up
World
with.
World Famous?
Yeah.
That's baller.
They figured that they would just dive right in and just be like, call it like, it's never been opened before.
Scene.
First day on the scene, we're World Famous Coffee. And so like I was studying there and trying to kind of like wrap my head around being back in the States, starting a grad degree, doing all that stuff. And that was very daunting. But the coffee scene seemed really cool and like kind of wide open. So I ended up taking a job there and like working as a barista. And so that was kind of the start to it. And that was like, 2004. Had to check the notes.
Question. This is a long shot. There's a gentleman that's been coming to our cafe ever since we opened by the name of Chris Levan. And before we opened, he's been in the Alpharetta area going and hanging out at coffee shops with his dogs.
Okay.
For a long time, but I don't know if you would have.
Chris Levan. I wonder if I would recognize him.
Real talkative gentleman. Says he invented carbon fiber.
Whoa. Allegedly.
Okay.
Some people believe it. Some people don't. But
that's quite the claim.
I believe it. He's a smart dude.
I haven't invented anything.
Come on.
Yeah.
Oh, us either.
Okay. So you got the job at World Famous.
Got the job at World Famous.
No, you're World Famous.
Gee, yeah. Was working there and then like was kind of hitting that space. I can't remember if my wife had just, you know, we were relatively newly married. We were still trying to figure things out and all that stuff. And I didn't see too much of a future there as like a manager or something. They had maybe made some commitments and I didn't think they were going to be fulfilled. So I was like, what do I do next? And then somebody from the church I was going to at the time was opening up a coffee shop like right up the street and needed somebody with experience and all. Ooh. As big air quotes as I could possibly put on that. So I was like, what, 6 months into reading some David Schomer articles and like working behind the bar.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you were into it. Like yeah, this wasn't like, just I'm working the job. It's like, this is cool.
There was a guy that was, he was big in the scene around here for a long time, a guy named Rob Tuttle, and he was one of the owners of World Famous. He was a barista judge and stuff like that for a number of years afterwards, but he super, like, kind of like y'all, really elevate and do a great job with it, all your shops, but hospitality-wise, Rob was amazing and super welcoming, and he just, like, infectious enthusiasm for everything he was doing. And so he I would come in there, I would just be studying, and he'd be chatting me up, and we'd be talking about stuff, and he'd be serving me espressos and just trying things, and just that idea of, like, you know, well, what's, why is it good sometimes? Why is it not good other times? And, like, what's this whole machine and how do you do it? And like that kind of complication and the fact, maybe at the time where there was a structure to the master's program of like trying to work through somebody's prescribed learning. The appeal in some anti-authoritarian kind of way of being able to just like explore this thing that there weren't any rules about with coffee mm-hmm. was maybe a little appealing. And so diving down this little rabbit hole. So, Rob's enthusiasm definitely got me kind of excited about it. So then I wanted to work as a barista. And so then I told my wife, rather than pursuing a professional career, that I wanted to try to be a barista. And that.
Been there.
Yeah.
Really? How'd she take it?
Better than she should have.
You sure?
Yeah, exactly. What are we doing? What's the.
Rob was one of the owners of World Famous. Mm-hmm. I know we got to keep moving, but just what? So this is a place that really cares about coffee. Like, especially if he's, you know, a judge, SCA, maybe if that's a thing yet. Like, what were some of the highlights or things you could point to? Of like, what was specialty coffee like in 2004? Because I'm 7 years old at that point. Also, where was World Famous? Was it just like in a strip?
It was at the corner of, what would that be, 141 and, what's it called there? Not Pleasant Hill.
Oh, like the PIB area, like that side?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what's over there now. It's not far from where Peach is located now.
Okay.
There's a Publix on one corner. Okay. There's a Stony River on the opposite corner. Like,
yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it was like right over there.
Abbots Bridge or something.
Suburbs kind of area.
Oh, yeah. Over there. Oh, yeah, very much so.
But like, are you guys weighing shots? Is there latte art?
No, no, like, no. This is shot glasses, you know, measuring to the line.
That's still probably cutting edge at the time, right?
It's not that bad, really.
No, it's not. I mean, it's like, it's not the end of the world.
Are the espressos big? Are they small? Is everything like really dark?
Yeah, there was like at the time they were using Delano's coffee roasters. Do y'all know DCR?
Mm-mm.
No.
Delano's.
Really? Ooh, okay. Need to do some digging.
We're babies.
Help us,
sorry,
David.
I didn't mean that in any sort of insulting way.
No, it's cool.
But they're one of those ones that, you know, you might not know, especially being East Coast like we are, like they're big West Coast and stuff. But like when you start sort of seeing their scope, it's pretty impressive where all they're at. But we had a bunch of coffees from them. I remember being behind the bar, like just working a shift. I'm just kind of standing there. It's a little slow because it's a new suburban coffee shop. And there would be like 3 or 4 air pots that we were, you know, constantly dumping and rotating every 30 minutes. And then we had like the blend descriptions, and I would read the blend descriptions and like pour up out of these air pots and try to sip and just be like, God, I can kind of tell, but I'm just not seeing it, you know? So I remember that kind of being a little bit frustrated by that, but it's not a shot against Delano's. That's just, you know, air pot coffee sitting there for 45 minutes and then sipping through it, trying to tell differences.
Mm.
But the shots were, we weren't weighing anything. We were using these interesting grinders that maybe are still out there, but like have kind of come back around, called Azkoyen, Azkoyen or something. Grinders that would like pre-grind, and then when you put the portafilter in, it just dropped the shot into the portafilter.
Oh.
So like beyond paddle, kind of?
It's not like the clicky-clack.
No, they're tall, skinny. They were sort of the shape of like a Mythos, but like when you would push the portafilter in, there was this real distinct like click noise, and it would just drop a dose of coffee into the portafilter. Whoa. And then you would hear it grind the next one.
Wow.
Yeah, it was kind of wild. And we used one of these, like there was a big like lever actuated automatic tamper kind of thing, or not automatic, but you just like pull the handle down and tamp kind of vibe.
Wow.
Two machines on the bar at the time. Yeah. That was kind of my start with
two machines.
Yeah. They wanted to make sure that they had enough machine power to handle all the capacity, which you never really worked out, but hey, they were planning. Which is another one of those things that I advise people against at the beginning of opening up a shop, unless you really have experience and you like know your volume. People who are like, we're gonna have two machines, and it's like,
seems wise,
you know, like not trying to oversell anybody on anything. It's like, how much you put in one machine and then a plug and a spare water outlet or like water connection, right, so that down the road.
I mean, I feel like wise we words. Do pretty decent volume on a two group
mod bar,
yeah. Well, that's why we, I mean. Only two of our group heads currently work on our Spirit. And busted. We were like, this is working. Let's just get a two-group Strata.
Mm-hmm.
And because you only have two hands. You
know? That's what I was about to ask. How does that work for y'all, like the two-group versus three-group? And I'm getting way off the topic.
No, you're fine. Personal history. So we usually have when everything was functioning, we've been away from this for a while, though. We had six portafilters. So it was prep three, rip three. While those are going, prep your other three and tried it. But obviously you're moving hands a lot more. And for bringing people on the team, it's a lot simpler just to two. So we have.
Do you still go back to like the six portafilter thing during really busy times or no?
Well, it's more like a four because you're pulling two, cleaning two, prepping two, and then firing those two off while you're cleaning the other two.
How many baristas do you have working that bar?
It varies. If you're in that kind of position, like if you're in a position where that needs to be happening, there's probably four or five, and that's probably all one person's doing is just making espresso. And then you have someone coming around them and doing like matcha, because we have a position called brewer where they start drinks, and then they have a position of expo where you're finishing drinks.
Sure.
And expo's delegating to like the bar supports the brewer, and then making sure things get out.
So is expo kind of running the show for everybody? A little bit.
Expo's kind of running the show on output, and then concierge is running the show for input, and they have their own support to like get things started with drips, kegs, food. And then expo and concierge need to have a good line of communication on managing input, output.
Yeah. Matcha is a position, huh?
No, I was a support. That would be something the support does instead of the person who's just doing the two port filters, because they're moving and grooving so much.
But yeah, with the three group, and you know, if we restructured the bar, I think the three group you could meet a level of efficiency. Mm. But for us, the way we have things set up, it's like having that, you know, if you have to set two port filters and then go back and get that third one and then fire it as well, it's like you're not gaining as much as it's worth for us specifically.
Mm-hmm. I hear that. Yeah, we never really used that second machine. Jumping all the way back to the history thing, there was like, it was one where that machine got used so little that even though it was meant to be kind of like the backup in case of emergency thing, that it would have more problems and we wouldn't really discover it until the first machine had an issue. And then you go try to jump over onto the second.
Yeah.
And it's not working.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about our GS3 right now.
It's like, probably okay. It's probably fine. It wasn't that cold for that long.
It's 33 now. We're good.
Oh my gosh. At 9 a.m. it's 30. Okay. So in 2004, right?
World famous.
I know you were just world starting famous, out. Yeah. And so you probably didn't have like a great view of the whole industry at that time. But on the point of what was the industry like at that time, were there any notable cafes around town that you could point to and be like, that was the hot cafe at the time?
Gosh, I'm trying to think what's still around. I mean, at the, you know, historically in Atlanta, Aurora Coffee down in Little Five.
Whoa.
That was a spot, right? Like,
do you think that was the first specialty coffee?
Hard to say. There's a company called J. Martinez, which is still around in Atlanta. And at one point, his father, so the original J. Martinez that was running it, and I probably not getting my story exactly right, but you can look back and see some old pictures, and he had just a bean shop, like a roasted coffee shop where you would go in, and it was like, they have a connection to like Jamaican Blue Mountain coffees and stuff. And so there was like the beautiful wood bar with like the scales, and you know, you're just coming in kind of like Starbucks before they started serving espresso. where it was just like a spice and beans kind of shop, and you were coming in buying your coffee. So that was one I never really got to see, but I've, you know, heard stories of and think it's pretty cool.
Let's bring it back, guys.
Right? No espresso, just like...
Yeah, people don't like espresso anyways.
Hey, I mean, if there's ever time to do it, I know online is huge, but like with the, I'm sure you guys seen during COVID, the amount of like at-home barista movement. I'm just saying, if you're in a densely populated area and you're just selling coffee that maybe you can't get online or something.
Yeah, right? I hear retail is doing really well.
Right? Yeah. Under the right circumstance.
I'm joking.
Low overhead, high inventory costs. Oh, and then it's slow and you're just looking at all of your coffee aging.
Yeah, it's just like one big clock. It's like having, you know, everything's just slowly.
Does anyone want to buy this?
Yeah, bag of coffee dying on the bar.
Lower overhead, though?
What's that?
Doing it from a warehouse and selling online.
That's true.
That's fair.
And you like get the orders in and then you just roast those orders.
Yes.
Maybe a little more. But okay, so anyways, you left... world famous.
Well, yeah. So I left Georgia Tech to work full time at World Famous. Now I'm going to be a coffee person. And at the time, it was like, oddly in my story, it was like we were so fresh from being back from having lived in Japan that I thought you know we were definitely going to get back there. But at the time, I didn't really feel like I had a career path necessarily. So I was like, oh, coffee. Like everybody loves coffee. Surely there's. You know, if I start working in coffee, it'll naturally just flow into ending up, you know, back in Japan. Mm-hmm. Didn't necessarily happen over the course of the 20 years, but that was some of the initial thought was like coffee overseas. So then I went and jumped to this other shop that was a little, you know, ill-advised just right up the street from there. Somebody who had like gotten a bunch of money, gotten a bunch of funding was, you know, built this really big kind of excessive space. Didn't have things nailed down on the back end as far as financials to figure out how they were going to pay for all that space.
Like month to month?
Yeah, or just like drink to drinking. It was quite the adventure. So I left, and at that time my wife was pregnant. We were like thinking in more of like future dad mode. And so some of the financial issues that we were facing at that startup made it so that didn't last very long. It was probably like maybe 4 to 6 months or something, and then ended up bouncing up the street to a coffee shop that was in a church that was like, they were looking for somebody with experience again. and at that point, I had at least a year, so maybe two. So then I jumped up there and was there for like a year and a half or so, a place called the Coffee Lodge, which still exists over in like South Forsyth area.
Coffee Lodge.
Yep.
That does sound familiar.
What's
inside of a church called First Redeemer? Like I didn't have any affiliation with the church, but there was like they were opening up. There was a guy that had some experience through Chick-fil-A and stuff that they had hired to kind of be like the hospitality dude.
Whatever. Yeah. They bought our
coffee.
They
buy your coffee?
I think
really?
They did for a minute.
For a span.
We've done a couple events there.
Really?
My uncle and aunt in-laws go there.
There you go.
No
connections,
joke.
Dude.
Uncle and aunt in law.
Yeah. Uncle Brad and Aunt Beth. Hey.
Still.
Hope you guys are doing well.
We know you're listening.
See you on the 23rd. We're getting together for Christmas. All right. So you're at the coffee lodge.
At the coffee lodge doing thing.
How dedicated to you? Because I feel like when a startup falls through, that would be a really pivotal point of like, am I going to keep doing this? Or do I need to find a different career path?
Yeah.
But you persevered.
It didn't feel like there was a lot of other career paths kind of laying out there at the time, you know? Like,
it was like 05, 06?
Yeah.
Timeline?
Like let's see.
What did Kathy say?
Exactly. Kathy said, yeah. It was probably like 04, 05, because my son was actually born the day before that coffee lodge was supposed to open.
Whoa.
So, like, I had to call in the first week or something like that and be like, hey, I'm not showing up because just had a kid.
Was paternal leave a thing in 2005?
No. But okay. There was a team of like the team that I had there, the opening barista team were some really awesome folks, most of whom were, you know, moms with kids that were associated with the church. Mm-hmm. So they were amazing. Could have done fine in the place without me. Like I had the most like kind of coffee dedication. But they had me covered. So when we were having the kid, they're like, now we got you. Mm-hmm. We're running this.
They got it.
Yep. But yeah, that's where I kind of was like getting into it a little more and like when that space originally opened up, they had already spec'd in and brought in like a super automatic espresso machine. So when I went in, they were like, oh, well, we've already got the espresso machine. It was a super automatic. They were using like a Starbucks We Proudly Brew kind of program through their food service provider. And I was like, can we change this up a bit? And so we ended up at least getting a like a traditional espresso machine.
That was the first time I had our coffee through a super auto was at the Coffee Lodge.
Oh, did they go back to a super auto?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think
that's got to hurt. I'm sorry you had to hear that. On air.
Was thwarted. Okay.
I'm good.
It was pretty good.
Was it? Okay.
It was pretty good. We did.
Oh, I wish we could just go there too and talk about super autos with David. But
we still got what, like 3 hours?
So, yeah. I'm a little wordy. I apologize if I'm not doing this right.
No, you're good. All right. Coffee Lodge. How long are you there?
2 years? Year and a half, something like that. And then, I'm doing a really bad job of like laying out the like career path is just stumble your way through it. But I think that's,
hey, we're prying. Okay.
At the time I was there, like that was one of those where, you know, we've had similar conversations, I think, with folks around, but that shop wanted to pay a good sustainable wage for like the person who was working there. Plus mm-hmm. had a family and stuff. I think they were pretty considerate of that. But just like what that coffee shop was bringing in versus what they were paying at some point, I think they were kind of seeing that it wasn't a real sustainable pathway. I sort of saw that coming. They saw it coming too. So it was like, I was thinking about the next thing. And right around that time, somewhere online on like one of the Coffee Geek type forums or SCA.org or something, like one of the forums from back in the day, it popped up that Counterculture was opening up a training center in Atlanta, and they'd like put out something, some sort of job description, and it was like, teach people, educate, support, do all this stuff. And it's like, oh my gosh, those are the things I like to do. So I kind of got a little bit focused on trying to go after that job. And that took like half a year or something from the time they began kind of posting that it was going to happen until it actually came to be. Mm. So it was all a very long process.
Whoa.
How old were you at that time-ish?
So bad at that math. I'm about to be... It was like right at, was that 18 years ago or something?
15 or 16. Yeah, exactly. 2005.
Okay, so
I was young.
What did they open that training center in the same place, like the King Plow? Mm-hmm. So it started there.
Yeah, they had like signed onto a lease before they had anybody doing anything. Like I think it sat fairly empty for a couple of months while they were trying to figure out who was actually going to work there and like make it a home for people around town. So they started, and this actually does fit into the whole career path thing, but it's like I wanted to be an educator. Like I wanted to be a barista trainer. I wanted to like teach people about coffee. I wanted to like focus on the fun stuff and do the support kind of things. And then when it actually came time to interview for the real job, the person I sat down with who became a great friend was like a really awesome boss and mentor, a guy named Rich Futrell. We sat down. I was super hyper focused on this job and thought it was like the perfect job for me. And the first thing he said was like, well, we already filled that position. How do you feel about sales? And it was like, oh, I've got strong feelings about sales, but it's not positive ones necessarily.
Whoa.
But you know, you got to make ends meet. So I was like, oh, sales sounds great.
I love sales.
Sales is awesome.
I'm so glad that the dream position filled up.
So,
wow.
So yeah, I became the salesperson again in the same way that I had experience to run the coffee shop.
Right.
Yeah, so you were like wholesale?
Yeah, it was the wholesale
rep person for Counterculture in the Southeast? Or yeah,
well, in Atlanta.
Atlanta.
At that time, it was like very small focus.
Got it. That's probably nice.
It was like small, dense, like they wanted to have, you know, deliver really good support and stuff like that to people in a small area.
And you got to work, right?
Try. Doing whatever we do.
A lot of Counterculture around here.
Yeah, at the time, there were two. At the time, it was Octane and this one other place, Indie Coffee and Books. And like that was it for accounts in the city at the time.
So they took a risk opening that training center.
Yeah.
But it paid off.
I mean, it did.
They did that first. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Isn't that wild?
You think you hit a critical mass of like, if we get 15 exclusive accounts, we'll invest in this space and it'll be awesome.
Right.
But it's like they did the cart before the horse and it...
Well, I think at the time, too, I mean, I think the math I mean, there was math being done, right? It wasn't like Brett was just kind of taking a dartboard and throwing stuff out there trying to find spaces. But at the time, I think that, you know, probably between Octane and that one other account, maybe like two or three accounts, there was enough volume to dictate the need for having a space to support those accounts, you know, by the math of that era and their growth. Mm. So it was like, it was kind of there. And then, you know, as we added staff and stuff like that, we needed to add more capacity.
How big was Counterculture when you joined? Oh, pop quiz.
About this big, it feels like. I don't know, like poundage-wise. I couldn't tell you.
Maybe how much even personnel-wise, if that is an easier number.
There was a picture at the time when there's an old picture, I think in Roast Magazine, where they won like Micro Roaster of the Year or something. And I think the whole staff was on the cover for the most part. And it's maybe 25 people. Mm-hmm. Something like that. We could go back and count.
Let's do it.
Some heavy hitters in there. But
quickly on that, Counterculture was the first good specialty coffee I ever had.
Okay,
it was
cool.
Buzira Guhindwa.
Yeah.
The natural.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, you know, like my friend made me a pour over that at his house. And I was like, whoa, that's crazy.
That's wild.
And so getting introduced to Counterculture that way, you know, they were the first coffee brand that I came to know that didn't have any didn't have any cafes, and I just wonder, like, what, having been a part of the company at that time, you know, what reflections do you have about their rise to success, having no cafes, going more of the training center model? You know, putting training centers in these areas. And they're from North Carolina, right?
Yeah, so they're originally from Durham. They started kind of in the Durham-Chapel Hill area. And, like, I think that was a big part of the success. Like, I tell the story a lot because especially folks that are in your position, like, as being new roasters in this new era, which is a very different era, I feel like, of coffee, just with the abundance of really cool, dedicated folks that are trying to roast really amazing coffees and are. But, like, the amount of people doing great stuff in a small area is a little different. And so it's like kind of the way that you sell and the amount of density you sell or the amount of accounts you have in one space is, I would assume, pretty different than what I was experiencing. There was a time where, like, when I was working there, the list of, you know, best coffee shops in Atlanta would often have a lot of places that were our accounts, right? It was kind of cool. And I think that just comes out of the fact that they didn't have cafes. So it's like, hey, we're trying to roast really great coffee. And then the main focus of what we're doing is just doing a really good job of supporting the people who want to serve great coffees at their cafes. And there weren't a ton of options at that time either. So right place, right time, I think.
I feel like Counterculture really set the standard for what wholesale support looks like in our industry, at least from where I sit.
I mean, I still have kind of that era of selling and supporting coffee as having been on the wholesale side. Cause there was a moment too, where I was the tech again, like lots of air quotes here. I was the tech. So I was kind of responsible for the equipment that we were selling.
Whoa.
There were some periods where I was the only employee. Then I had like a couple of coworkers and like we went through some different cycles there. But yeah, it was a very small focus. Like it was all trying to happen within an area that I could feasibly manage to like run around to shops. I mean, at the time there was people that would like forget to order coffee and I'd go borrow a couple bags of coffee from one place that had some and drive it across town to another and be like, here's 10 pounds of coffee.
Wow.
Maybe not the most sustainable approach, but.
But that is so impactful, you know, like to be able to just bop around to different accounts and that be your pretty much singular focus.
Yeah.
Just support.
Mm-hmm. Just get out there and try to like help the people that are doing cool stuff. But, I think it's interesting because like that identity, and I feel like I associate with that a lot personally too, is just like trying to be a little bit of a helper to a lot of folks rather than being like the entrepreneur who's driving and creating, you know, your own brand with your own identity. Mm-hmm. It's always just kind of like being a little bit in the background, supporting people. But that's interesting too, because as you're trying to kind of build a brand and so much of what you do is supporting other people, then like, what does your branding look like? What is, you know, how are you defining who you are? In relation to who those other people are who are really kind of on the front end of serving it. Not sure.
How long were you with Counterculture?
Just short of, I think like a little over 9 years, just like a little bit short of 10.
Wow. How, I'm sorry. I have to ask.
Please. I feel like I'm talking way too much.
How did their roasting philosophy change over that period, would you say? Because, I mean, as far as like being a pioneer of what we know as specialty coffee today, I'm just wondering, over a 10-year period, did you see any big shifts? Because, I mean, I'm obviously over that period of time, there were shifts in the industry.
Right.
So as far as selling that and selling across potential shifts, like, did you see any of that?
I feel like there were some cool lessons that I sort of see being reapplied now, or like, you know, trends that come and go. When I first started, it was interesting because like I kind of didn't know what I was doing. Again, like, hadn't been a salesperson before, was a little bit of a reluctant salesperson. And so just the process of selling was a little new to me. So when I had people that were like, the first couple of times I remember having like a true sales meeting, and I'm on my own, I'm in Atlanta, and I'm like, you know, somebody wants to open a shop and they want to choose which coffee they've decided on counterculture, but they want to decide what their coffees are going to be. And we used to work with them to do like house blends. And so we had this huge list of blends that had kind of evolved over the years. And so I was like, okay, so I, you know, write an email to counterculture, the team. And I'm like, okay, send me like whatever, regular number 35 and organic number 10 and like all these different things. Number 46, you know, which is still a blend of theirs. That's the reason it's called 46 is because it was number 46 on the list. Yep.
That's a freebie, guys.
Right. So fun fact. So then like I set up this tasting with this customer of a bunch of these different blends that were just kind of numbers. And then the option still existed for them to come in and like taste these coffees and be like, well, I kind of like something between number 46 and number 47. It's like, okay, well, now let's create number 50.
Oh my gosh.
So we're going to tweak it a little bit. So there was so much customization going on per account that years later, the guy who was in charge of, you know, the coffee program, a guy named Tim Hill, it became his job to like try to simplify that, because we had grown on creating a lot of blends for people and creating a lot of stuff. Mm. But then it just became unsustainable, because then like every single big customer thinks that they want a coffee with a little bit of Mexico in it or a little bit of Colombia or something.
Wow.
So
how do you take that away?
Very carefully, very gently.
Yeah.
You know, I think the key thing was trying to like taste your way through it, like to convince people, like to show people, not convince, to show people that tasting the coffees, like that you're actually getting something better if you're picking a coffee that's going to stay fresher longer, or that's based on something that tastes good and kind of hits that flavor target, rather than just saying, we have family connections to Honduras, therefore, like all year long, we need, you know, our coffee to be mostly Honduras or something. Does that make sense? I don't know. So.
Wow.
You got any sales tips for us?
I was about to ask the same. You guys got sales tips for me. Like don't oversell, don't overpromise. I don't know.
On the note about the customization on the menu, it makes so much sense why that was such an attractive feature at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like at that time, I don't know, and I even see it now where like the lever you can pull to make the sale is like, what if we made you your own blend, you know? And I think for some people that's really attractive, and some people it's not.
Do y'all do it a fair amount? Do you do like?
We do it occasionally.
Okay.
One of the reasons I bring it up is early on, we would just do anything we could to get coffee out the roaster, you know, for better or for worse. And now we're a lot more selective with who we do that for.
Right.
We're actually really excited about it. And, you know, like we actually think that they're going to sell more coffee and we're going to sell more coffee because of that arrangement. And we're working on something now with one of our partners.
Oh, cool.
I'm really pumped about, and some recommendations that he made has basically, like, we're about to roll out a dark roast.
Okay.
And nice. It's mostly because of him.
Oh, really? That was really what he wanted. And
yeah. Like, and so
he made a good one.
A customer giving really good feedback and really good ideas is awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, for him to like change the way that we're structuring our menu is
that going to hit everybody? I mean, are you going to be able to apply that coffee like beyond just his accounts or like not? I mean, it might be an exclusive for him, but are you guys, do you have a dark roast that you're rolling out to?
His coffee will be some dark roast, some other coffee. But the dark roast itself will be its own product that will be available for anyone. So
it's not crazy, crazy dark. No. Like
it's just like Full City Plus.
Full City Plus.
Yeah.
Whatever that
means. It's definitely a good bit darker than anything we've ever done. So we're still figuring out all the logistics around it, but
did Delano's say stuff like that?
It's like the Full City Plus. Oh yeah. There was a lot of like the Full City Plus city, like that whole language of things. Yeah.
What are your favorite coffee terms that are no longer used?
Those. Oh my gosh.
Because he always pulls those out. He's always like full city.
Vienna Rose.
Yeah.
Stockfleth's move. Do you all know that one?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. See,
Stockfleth is awesome.
We learned that from Chris Vaca.
Okay.
He made a video about it one time.
About distributing.
I think we used it for a little bit. And then we started tapping.
Oh, my gosh. Right. I'll give you some time to think about it. But do you have any thoughts on like all this coffee tech on redistributing espresso and...
so many thoughts.
The auto comb and the WDT.
I think it was still called the WDT. But you know, it was like the yogurt cup and like a stir stick. It was a move. So like, I actually found this photo the other day or yesterday when Kathy and I were trying to figure out timelines and stuff. There was one point where when I just started at Counterculture that I invited a bunch of the local coffee geeks through the Coffee Geek Forum and just was like, y'all come hang out, like teach me stuff. I just, you know, let's get together and do like a little home coffee person's get together. And somebody brought like yogurt cup with the bottom of it cut off and it fit perfectly into a portafilter.
58 millimeters, baby.
Yeah, exactly. It fit right in and then you could put in the coffee and they were like stirring and just like.
We're talking Yoplait?
What's that?
Like
what would it have been?
You know, like the cylindrical.
Yeah, this is pre-Chobani. So it was probably like Yoplait
before the merger.
Hey, Chobani's hot topic right now.
Is that right?
$900 million
for La Colombe.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Jeez.
We're close, guys. We are close.
We're almost there.
We're almost there.
A few more podcasts, 800 more cafes. We're there.
Yeah. So, yeah, the plastic cup into the portafilter, stirring. And it's so the thing that I think is interesting is to me, that always, like, there's interesting ideas that come out of that that maybe, like, I don't know how y'all feel about it. In the cafe, are you going to have, can you get that in depth with espresso prep process or do you have to wait for it to kind of be commercialized to become something that can fit more smoothly into the volume that you do?
I think it just happened for the first time it's viable with the Barista Hustle auto comb.
Yeah, the little.
And we still don't use it on everything.
Do you have one?
We do. We have one at each cafe.
We have two.
Wow.
Because we tried. I don't want to drag them through the mud too much, but we tried the Weber Workshops Moonraker, which is like.
You have one of those too?
It's over there.
Two. We have two, what? David.
You can,
yeah, sorry, yeah.
You can listen. Showing some shock. You can have that one of those.
$50. No, it's yours.
I'm going to send you home with one you can use it at home. Yeah, no, I am.
It's like being gifted a nice watch. It's crazy.
Well, it didn't work in our cafes because. It had no way to protect the needles, and then the base would bend the needles.
Oh.
So that didn't work. Auto comb, though, and the needles still get bent. We need to replace a couple right now, but we use it for anything cappuccino or smaller.
But obviously you've done enough testing on it that like it makes enough of a difference in the process for you to incorporate that, right? I mean, is that – did you do the side-by-side of just like baristas doing their own thing, not distributing well, or – stock blessing.
I've done the side by side, and then especially with the Moonraker, I like broke out a refractometer and tested, and it does increase extraction yield.
Okay,
I think the biggest win is when you're doing anything on the EK too. Like if you're doing an EK espresso, it comes out all clump clump,
little rake rake, and you're good to go.
Little rake rake, and you're good.
Numbers are one thing, but I do think taste wise, more even extraction.
Okay.
If you better whereas without it, you probably have some amount of micro channeling here and there.
Yeah,
but I think it really gets rid of it.
I think that's the thing that's cool is like, what's the stuff that's coming from people's home routines where you've got no pressures of trying to hit a certain amount of time, or do it over and over and over. But what can stand the test of like making it to the cafe and going into practice?
Mm-hmm. We got to keep moving. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Counterculture, just under 10 years. And then is it straight from Counterculture to La Marzocco?
Yeah. So we had kind of pretty topical at the moment. So right now, La Marzocco is releasing the Strata X, which y'all might have seen, which is like a very cool evolved pressure profiling machine. Can do lots of stuff. I still got to get some, got to spend some time with it. But about 8+ years ago, they had the Strata EP, which was kind of the first run at pressure profiling. We were really kind of breaking new ground, trying to do stuff. And we learned a lot from that process of how it works. I mean, very same body, but just a different function internally. And La Marzocco kind of came on a, went on a tour to a bunch of different places, showing off that machine, kind of talking about pressure and flow. And they came through Atlanta and did a, did an event at the Atlanta Training Center. And somebody mentioned something about like that they were going to be trying to hire for a support position. And I had a bunch of coffee friends in the industry that I like work all kind of like against the, they were at the max of where they might've moved within the companies they were at. So I had this kind of list of names in my mind. I was like, oh, those people could be really perfect for this job, you know, get to jump and work for a really cool company like La Marzocco. So I think I reached out to them and was going to try to sort of put some names in front of them. And then I don't know if it was mid call or if it was like a change of mind or something in the course of time. But once again, they were like, well, we're looking for a salesperson. And I'm still thinking, not sure if I like sales, but here I am this many years in doing it. And I was like, oh, really? So that started a conversation and ended up making the jump. So I had been kind of doing pseudo tech work for all those years at Counterculture and was obviously very familiar with the product. And also too, like for me at the time, like the coffee industry has always been about connecting with the people. And like, that's kind of why I got into it, was to, you know, indulge a love of like getting to know folks and having a lot of friends. And over the course of my time at Counterculture, a lot of those accounts had either graduated away and people had gone to work for other coffee companies or were getting ready to start new roasters and doing things like that. And it kind of, to me, felt like an opportunity to kind of follow them in some ways and like continue to hopefully make some inputs into their careers and just like support what they were doing. From the side of La Marzocco rather than ending up as competitors with Counterculture. I don't know.
Makes sense.
That's awesome. What is it like selling? Because, okay, you're, at Counterculture, you're selling a product where people are going to be buying it on a recurring basis. I've always wondered, what's it like selling this one massively expensive product, and it's almost as if your entire lifetime value of some customers is just like lies within that one sale.
It was weird. It felt like, you know, if you've got a clock that's running at a certain pace, like with getting used to that wholesale coffee sales sort of interaction time frame, like the way that people were opening up shops, how often they were ordering, how often we were interacting, like it felt like it was like on a pace. And then when I moved to La Marzocco, it felt like it cut down by, you know, 300% as far as like now it's just on this really slow pace. Like
we're not client golf.
So much client golf.
Yeah.
Which has happened, which is funny that we mentioned that client golf. It's happened precisely one time in the course of my
years. Talk of the industry, though.
So, yeah, it's like you said, people are making a big decision one time. And then hopefully, if our brand is, you know, if our product is doing what it's supposed to, they're not having to replace it until 10, 15 years later. So just all those interactions, just like the pace of everything. And even too, like how often we're rolling out new equipment. Back in the day, it was like, we're rolling out a new blend. We're putting out a new coffee. Like something new is showing up all the time. And then seasonality, like the Bustierga Hinda was going away and the new, you know, the Coke is coming in or something. And now it's like Coke. Adido.
Adido.
Kebab.
And so now it's like one machine every 3 years, 2 years, whatever. So it's just like a different splash, pace. Though.
I bet you've had a lot of people hitting you up after this most recent cycle.
Yeah, I think there should be, there's fingers crossed everything comes together schedule-wise, but there should be an event happening here in Atlanta somewhere around the Strata X and a bunch of other innovations we have happening post-SCA, I think.
Cool.
So,
what's your favorite thing about La Marzocco machines?
Favorite thing about the machines, it was funny when you started saying La Marzocco, it was like immediately to the people, and then you said machines. I was like, oh yeah, machines. I mean, my favorite thing about them, it sounds weird. I feel like that's a kind of a cop-out. My favorite things about the machines are the people behind the machines and the stories behind them and stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And the people working on them, right? It's like, it's a privilege that I don't even really kind of fully comprehend and grasp to be this connected to this many cool people in the industry who are doing amazing things with the tools that we make.
Yeah.
You know, on all ends of the spectrum too, whether it's like the most refined person with the, you know, Moonraker and frozen steel balls and stuff like that to the shops, like the drive-thrus that are cranking out some volume that use it, not because of how refined it is, but because of how durable it is, you know, that they're just beat the life out of it until the ears on the portafilters wear away and just about snap off.
What? Those Marzocco portafilters are awesome.
I agree.
There's I've never held a better portafilter, and they're pricey. Like, they're more expensive than other ones, but there's a difference for sure.
I love them. Like, that was one of the cool switches that I remember, like, back in the day, my first La Marzocco that I worked on, which was on that church coffee shop that I mentioned way back after World Famous Coffee.
Coffee Lodge.
Yeah. So after Coffee Lodge was Higher Grounds Coffee.
Come on.
That was the one. He bought one of those used Starbucks machines for like $2,000 after Starbucks went all super auto. And there was like a bunch of machines that were supposed to be decommissioned, but ended up back on eBay for super cheap. Mm-hmm. Those portafilters back in the day were like a coated brass. So at night, like, pop out the portafilter basket and you're going to clean it out. And it's just like espresso had like locked onto the brass. So you're like scrubbing, trying to get it off. So when we made the switch to stainless steel portafilters, it was like, run under a little water, a little pass with a towel, and all of a sudden it's clean. It's so good.
You're good. Yeah. I mean, on the Simonelli machine, that was the thing. Like, you, after a day of service, it's caked on there under the basket. And then if somebody didn't clean it the night before, you can forget about it. Like, that's just your portafilter now.
Green scrubby and like the smell of like brass and
cafeta. But the quality of that metal is, it's so resilient to coffee oils, which is such a niche topic. But
there
it
was
makes me so happy.
Speaking of niche, there was a moment.
We did a whole episode on that.
Gosh, we'd have to dig back to the archives again to look and see. Do you guys know about portaflon?
No.
I'm just thinking about the Mexican dessert.
Yeah, right? That would be way better if it was like portable flan.
You just have
like
to go.
Pocket full of listening. Flan. Like a go-gurt tube, but with flan.
Hey, we are
Drop it.
Right now.
Don't put this out on the market, all right?
There's the money.
Yeah. This is our new RTD area. Portaflon.
There was a brief moment before we did the stainless steel where there was like Teflon-coated portafilters and steam wands.
And steam on?
Whoa. Yeah. Yeah.
But it...
And Teflon's got a bad rap now.
Yeah, and once you open up that portafilter, look at that steam wand after X number of uses, and it's not there anymore.
It's gone. Yeah.
So, stainless steel.
Yeah. My favorite thing about La Marzocco machines is how durable they are. It's the perfect blend of durability and the technology.
Yeah.
And the design. Because I just feel like it's 100 on all of them.
I appreciate that.
You know, and because throughout the years of espresso machines being introduced into the market, in my short career, I've noticed machines that are too heavy on design and leave durability on the table, or they just look... I can't think of any espresso machine that's too high on durability but too low on design, you know, which is a reflection of the industry, and that's a cool thing. But every machine looks beautiful. They're all tanks, and they obviously brew great coffee, but that should be given. But do you think La Marzocco will ever go super auto?
No.
Like,
we work on innovations that are meant to sort of like support the barista. You know, like, the barista is such a core part of who we are and like the culture of what we do. And, you know, again, too, I don't want to say that somebody who stands behind a super automatic and like makes drinks for somebody isn't a barista. I wouldn't say that, but it's kind of like, this is the tool for people who want to get more involved in the process.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's what drew me in. Like, Rob's enthusiasm was awesome, but like getting on an espresso machine for the first time and being like, oh, this is cool. Oh, but this is also kind of complicated. Like, why is this both exciting but very difficult, and like, why is the output vary, and like, what could I do if I really started messing around? That's what I feel like really set the hook. And I feel like it's probably that way for a lot of people. I don't know, like, when was your moment of kind of getting drawn into the coffee industry? Like, did making espresso play into that for any of y'all? Or was it more just the people in the coffee?
I think the first time I ever really drank straight espresso was at a counterculture lab in Asheville.
Really?
Yeah. Like when we were training for our espresso fundamentals class.
Was it good? Or did you enjoy it? That's a better question.
I'm sure I didn't really enjoy it that much.
It's good. It's good. It's good.
I feel like I maybe enjoyed it more than I like thought I would. Because I'm sure they did some sort of like salami shot type of.
Salami shot? What's a salami shot?
It's where you put a cup under the espresso coming out for the first 5 seconds and you rotate and you just show.
Where's the salami part of the name come from? Slicing the salami.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That's another Chris Baca-ism.
I should know that then.
Yeah. We kind of cut our teeth on Cat and Cloud.
We did. Mm-hmm. We really did.
My first time was espresso too, of like, whoa, coffee can be something crazy, because I was getting trained by a guy from Stumptown.
Okay.
And so we were pulling shots of Hairbender on like this paddle grinder and bought off auction crappy espresso machine from the 90s.
Nice.
And awesome. He was like trying to dial it in, which was so nice of him to do. I'm sure you've been in some moments of that in wholesale. You're like,
so stressful.
All right,
you walk in and somebody's like, training starts in 20 minutes.
You're like, so there's no water filter. This is the grinder and this is the machine. Okay. Yeah, let's do it. And he was like, hey man, 26 seconds. Just try to get the shot to come out in 26 seconds. You'll be all right.
Right.
And that's when I was like, oh, this is palatable.
Interesting. Yeah, palatable.
And we'd go both directions and see what happens when it took a long time or came out really fast. And I was like, oh, wow, this is so crazy.
How do y'all, like, when do your, if I'm like brand new baby barista, not even baby barista, just never worked in coffee before, and I come and I apply, got a good enough personality to kind of like make the team at Valor. How do you approach getting them to taste espresso and like learn espresso? Do you force that appreciation on them? Do you like, how do you work it in? Salami shots?
The last three people we brought on, I've gotten the honor just to hang out with them for like their first several hours, bring them here. This is like post-culture orientation about like what we're going for in terms of excellence and empathy and hospitality. And I'm like, all right, let's taste some coffee. And, within that first week, I'd love for them to do a cupping. It's a little more easy on the palate, but we'll do the salami shot thing. And then I'm like, all right, we're going to like make espresso taste good. And so kind of do what, I'm really forgetting that guy's name from Stumptown.
I was about to ask who it was.
Michael, right?
So Mike Horgan?
Mike. Yeah. Shorter guy, beard. Horgan, yeah. Maybe, lived in North Carolina.
Yep.
His wife was a baker.
Okay.
It's all coming back.
And then it was Jared Ray.
Okay.
Then
yeah.
he was the yeah. rep for the Stumptown. But it does kind of come back to like just showing how it varies. And we get nerdy pretty quick, but I'm just trying to like display the inverse of like when coffee comes out, it starts as strong as it'll be and it just gets weaker, but it's as under extracted as will be and it'll continue to extract, and we'll highlight how making espresso hits all those different metrics and
interesting
planes. And I'm just like, I know you don't drink black coffee, but you do now.
You're welcome. Yes, here you go. You sparked a thought. When I was working at World Famous, there was a girl who was there who had worked at Starbucks, and she was like super helpful as well. I forget her name. But she showed me one time, like somebody was ordering espresso, and like I was still like tasting it, still not really sure about it. And she was the one who was kind of, it was her little secret technique that she had learned, where she would start the shot, let the first bit start flowing, and then cut in midway. And I remember that was one of the shots I had. I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting and good. But it was funny, just like you were saying, technique-wise, like in an effort to try to make that espresso more enjoyable, she was just kind of skipping the front end of it altogether.
Huh.
Just leaving that first cup out of the equation and then just jumping in and...
I honestly was doing a salami shot Monday, and I had that exact same thought. I was like, what if we just skipped it? I don't know.
Like, you know, scraping the crema kind of vibes, you know?
Right.
You pull four shots with just the good part.
The middle.
Yeah.
I think we'd probably incorporate more WDT before we did that.
All right. Thank you for your order.
Just
of
waste
the
a ton of coffee.
Yeah, 16 exactly. ounce mocha. It will be ready in 10 to 15 hours. Yeah.
Just catching the best little.
Hey, we still got a coffee review to do.
Oh my gosh.
I'm sorry. I feel like.
And I'm going to go pee because my bladder's going to explode.
Better hurry. Have you heard us review a coffee in the past?
Oh, I have, but I'm not. I don't have the system.
Oh, I'll lay it out.
Through scoring kind of stuff.
All right, so we start. There's kind of two categories: one of packaging, one of taste of the coffee. So we should start with packaging, and then we have content out of 10, aesthetic out of 10, and user experience out of 10. out of 5. Sorry, out of 5.
Wait, user experience is out of 5. Everything is out of 10.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
but he was the only user.
Yeah, so usually just the user gets to grade the user experience.
The UX.
Okay.
And this is tricky. We've never reviewed multiple things at one time, so maybe we could lay a quick ground rule or some thought. Do we want to just review this one? Because this one, the cappuccino was awesome. I didn't care too much for it on filter.
And I feel like it would only be fair to do that one because that was the only one that you did all three. All right.
Well, methods. Then maybe this could be the honorary round where we talk about, did anyone have any thoughts on these? And then we'll just cut straight to this.
Sure.
The Panama Geisha I thought was amazing. I thought it really shone and it was clean and it had some really awesome flavor. I love that it was washed because these were both anaerobic honey.
This was washed?
Yes.
Yeah. Pretty awesome. Obviously, the packaging is amazing.
Yeah.
UX, I'm like, does it, you lose points that I had to go get a screwdriver? I don't know.
I was about to ask about that. What's it like getting into
the thinking about that.
I was like, well, I guess I'm going to get a flathead. Maybe other people have paint keys.
I was going to say, you could do the branded paint key. That'd be pretty
branded
awesome.
Branded paint key.
Right.
I was thinking more like butter knife would work. You know, most people have butter knives.
You could hurt
That's
yourself.
That's a proven fact.
Can you use a portafilter basket to open that?
Oh, you totally.
Totally.
100%.
You think?
I think so.
It'd be really cool if it like locked right on or something. I didn't think this was anything crazy. I was just kind of drinking it and I was like, this tastes like a coffee from El Salvador. That's it. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on it.
I thought it was just clean. And fun.
Clean, easy drinking fun.
I mean, if you call this fun, maybe that's not fun. But like, that was crazy. The is that a Panama, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, the El Sal, I think it was just a really high quality, easy drinking coffee. But you know, when you put it in a 100 grams, I there's always a temptation to make coffees in tins or smaller quantities be like absolutely crazy tasting.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense, but does absolutely crazy tasting equate to quality? I guess that depends on what consumers think, but.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Double anaerobic honey means that it was anaerobic process for 2 48-hour cycles, once in cherry, and then another time after pulping, multiple washes, and a precise 35-day drying phase.
Wow.
That makes sense that it would affect the flavor. Like it goes through the anaerobic process in the cherry and out of it.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Let's stay focused.
Yep.
This label on the front of a white bag, we've always talked about how they do this so well. And it's like, probably makes them be able to do really cool, different packaging all the time and is cost effective. And I didn't notice that it wraps around to the bottom for UPC and a QR code,
which
is really cool.
Get the ugly stuff out of the way.
Yeah.
Stamp.
Yeah, we've always looked to this packaging for the big label on a bag look. And I don't know if we have been inspired by it, but we've also like ripped off the whole like paint can label. Remember when we did that for a little bit? But anyways,
yeah. How about content out of 10?
Just this bag, right? Not these.
Just this bag. I think we got to stay fair. There's not a ton of words, but there is a QR code.
Right, and you can tell for maybe the people that like words or are interested, they do not hold back on their...
SL28, like the Kenyan variety, yeah?
Yeah.
Check that
out. In El Sal. Very cool.
Okay. All right, content out of 10. 1, 2, 3, 7.
I said 8. What'd you say? You say anything?
I didn't say anything. I was
you can also refrain process. If you want to.
I like the simplicity. Yeah, I wrestle back and forth with like really simple, just like just the information you need versus the super in-depth versus like the whole booklet kind of thing.
What was the 7? Where are you coming from?
There's just not a lot of content on it.
It's got all the stuff you like, though. You like the Instagram and the address and the...
There's nothing about the business because there's only one label in the front. I would rather them not put anything about
the business on the front.
That would look really terrible.
That's tough, yeah.
And then they just obviously don't want to do 2 labels.
I like specialty coffee roasters journey of how do you match light, medium, dark roast in your own language, you know? And like, so mild, curious, wild.
Mm-hmm. What do y'all use? What's your language around that?
Nothing.
we have no metrics.
You don't have like the Explorer.
We have
like this.
Well, we have colors, color coded boxes. So, but that is like for someone who knows what they're getting into. This is like anybody could understand. Or like I know Onyx does traditional to modern, which I really like that too. And it's on like a linear point. Mm-hmm. What if we did like a X, Y axis graph and there's 4 different points and we chart each coffee?
Yeah.
We're going to do something.
Because I really like this. I like mild, curious, wild.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how many people buy on that. Of the folks that are out there buying that are...
I bet from maybe like a website filtering standpoint, maybe that's where they...
Gotcha. Makes sense.
And in cafe, helping someone figure out what they want standpoint of like...
Right.
Smart.
It's smart.
Just mild.
If you could categorize on your retail shelf, like buy that...
It says bit cool. different, too, on there, and I think that each coffee...
This is the name of the coffee, right?
I'm not sure, but I know that they kind of use those terms in conjunction with mild, curious, wild, I believe.
Yeah.
Bit different.
All right. Aesthetic, out of 10. 1, 2, 3, 9. 7. 10. 10, 9. 7. 7.
I think I said 6, but 6. I don't know. Just like simplicity versus, I mean, we've got these here too.
So yeah. I'm going to call that an 8.
Sure. They've just been going for the same thing and I respect it.
It's
all
timeless.
Right? It's really goofy and funny and yet they have still been doing it for a long time. Feel like this is, one could think it's just a flash in the pan design and then you go back to your timeless thing, but it's like they've just rocked the crazy through and through.
True.
I dig the... probably unintentional, but Gravity Falls type vibe with the Bill Cipher's style eye on the pyramid.
Oh, yeah.
Makes you think.
Go there.
Makes you think.
I'm thinking.
Ethan, how is the UX?
Oh, man. From a bag perspective.
What more could you ask for?
It ripped. It
zipped. I was like, came out great. I mean, dude, I guess 4.
All right. 4. Sounds good. All right. Flavor.
On that this coffee.
Yes.
Was that the one?
This was also a very expensive coffee.
Oh, that one.
Really?
This one, yeah. This one I don't know what... Oh, okay. It's out of stock as this size now, so I don't know how much it was, but for a 1 kilo, it was... It's really interesting how they do their stock levels. You can only get this in a 1 kilo ground for drip. Everything else is out of stock. And it's $148 for a kilo.
I've never even seen $148 before. Yeah.
So that's a lot. I'm like, was this 40? 50? Something?
Mm. Oh, holy crud.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Pardon my French, but holy crud. I thought it was pretty good, but the cappuccino I thought was awesome.
How did y'all brew that one that we tried?
Well, so that one was espresso, filter? Cappuccino, and the filter that was in this cup.
He used the Fellow Stag XF.
Oh, that's what you're asking.
Gotcha. Yes.
You ever play with that one?
No, not yet.
Pretty good. It's good. Good device. It's over there.
All right, flavor. 1, 2, 3, 7.
Five.
I said 7.
I think I said 7.
7. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, what's going on?
I judge it in the context of the price, you know.
Well, you're overruled. I'm giving it a 7. I'm just kidding.
We were having this discussion recently about the whole like price versus like if you pay a ton for something, does it need to be over the top crazy, like something I've never tasted before, or is it like the refined, very beautiful version of a coffee that you're kind of familiar with?
Mm-hmm. I guess what's hard for me in this specific context is I don't like cherish the flavors that are usually mm-hmm. inherent to El Salvadorian coffees. It's usually like pretty peppery and like vegetal to me. And I'm like, it's pretty good. That's why it's a 7. Because I bet it's like, you know, it's awesome. But we had we brewed up like a competition anaerobic bourbon one time, and it was like one of the craziest tasting coffees we've ever had. But it's just like, is that what you're going for?
I want like 3 sips of
this. I'm like, I can't drink any of this right now. I can drink it once, and I'm like, it's good.
All right, enjoyability is more in terms of, you know, would you drink this coffee every day? I'm thinking more specifically about how that cappuccino was in terms of milk, etc. 1, 2, 3, 9.
6.
8, 6, 9, 7. Yeah.
I think we said 6, 7, 8, 9. So
7.5. 7.5.
That's math.
All right.
It was enjoyable.
All right.
Yeah, crunch. I could drink a lot of that coffee.
You ever crunch coffee beans?
All the time. That's going way
good. Good man.
So we're not crazy.
No. Oh, you giving the Quaker?
He took the Quaker.
Better spit this out.
Sorry. I didn't mean to question your like the Quaker your crunch choice, but
oh wow. This tastes like Captain Crunch berries.
Yeah, I get that. It's a good crunch.
That is a good crunch.
That's a 5 out of 5.
I get that a 5 crunch.
5.
5.
All good. Right. There I'll tally you. Up.
Thank you again, folk at Proud Mary. Also, yeah. I saw your Rivian truck mobile setup.
And oh my gosh, that was crazy.
Whoa, I haven't seen that yet.
Just do a little scroll on their Instagram.
What do they have on their machine wise? What's the gear?
I think it was a mini.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. But yeah, they have this drawer that goes in the side of the Rivian, and they set it up on the truck bed, and yeah, it's unbelievable. The most audacious, ridiculous thing I've ever seen, but it's super cool.
It's just driving around?
I don't know exactly what the arrangement is with the Rivian, but whatever it is, even if it was just on Instagram.
Who drives it?
It's awesome.
Where are they going?
Yeah.
Yeah. How many catering events are they doing?
I don't know.
What's the cost involved?
This was one of my favorite coffees I've ever had.
I want to retry.
Kind of unfair. We should have just graded this, and it would have been our highest scoring coffee ever, probably.
Next to the, have you ever had Fried Hats? Have you heard of that?
No.
Smaller company. That's the current top ranker.
What was the coffee?
It was a geisha, which is funny.
It was in a pill bottle.
I think it was a Colombian.
It was in a pill bottle? Like
that's like their branding. What? It's like a big, like think supplement. Fish
oil. Okay.
Yeah, like not Costco supplement fish oil. Bottle. Yeah. Gotcha. Not like prescription.
I was like, wow, they're just like selling it one drink at a time. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you don't have to push down to turn.
I think it was a Colombian geisha that took the cake, but what was the total?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
38.5.
Out of 50.
Yeah, so one of our highest scoring ones. It's
really?
Up there.
Okay.
We score in that range a lot. We really do. But it kind of all balances out because it might be like the coffee's not awesome, but like the packaging's crazy or like everything is good or anyways.
I want to try more of that one. I was nervous about the start of the podcast and wasn't paying attention to what I was drinking as well. So
liquid was going
down. I want to go back to that. I don't want to miss out on that.
Oh, yeah. Well, hey, thank you for being here.
Thank you guys for having me.
It's funny you say you were nervous because you were excellent. So.
Oh.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know.
And we'll edit out the part where we just said you were nervous.
edit out the parts I messed up on. So, yeah, take out the big chunks. Yeah.
Thanks, David. We appreciate
Anytime,
it.
Anytime, yeah. y'all.
Thank you. Hey, thank you,
thanks guys. For yeah, thanks for listening.
See you next week.
We'll see you guys next week.